The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online. Plus, we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to the Edition podcast from The Spectator, where each week we shed a little light on the thought process behind putting the world's oldest weekly magazine to bed. I'm Laura Prendergast, The Spectator's executive editor.
And I'm William Moore, The Spectator's features editor.
Well, it's Wednesday afternoon. The magazine went to press today at 1:30 and our cover line is "Bricking It. Is Rishi ready for a Red Wall rebellion?" It's a bit of a tongue twister.
Yes.
Well, talk us through this cover and why we came up with it this week.
Well, Lee Anderson, of course, defected to the Reform Party on Monday. And Katie argues in her cover piece that this is indicative of two things. Firstly, the final collapse of the Tories' 2019 electoral coalition. So between the Red Wall in the north and the Blue Wall in the south. But it's also indicative of what you might call the new split in the right. And increasingly, it looks like these two sides just can't be reconciled. So I think really what's great about this cover piece is it's showing how, you know, you could just say Lee Anderson's just one MP defecting. But there's a kind of ripple effect of it that will cause huge problems for the Tories in the coming months, in the lead up to the general election, and, you know, could make things very sticky for them indeed.
Mm, and it doesn't really feel like Rishi has got much of an answer to what seems to be a kind of growing issue for him.
Well, exactly. There's a good bit in the piece where Katie says, you know, they can't call Lee Anderson a crank because, I mean, until very recently, he was the party's deputy chairman. So he was a pretty high-profile figure in the Tory party. So you can't just dismiss him as an oddball and a weirdo.
And who better to talk to you about this than Richard Tice, the leader of Reform UK, and our political editor, Katie Balls.
Katie, I'm going to start by putting to you the question that you ask in your cover piece for The Spectator this week. With Lee Anderson's defection to Reform, how big a threat does Reform now pose to the Tories?
I think it poses a big threat. And before you get to what the threat is, I think the reason it poses a big problem is because Reform doesn't have to be hugely successful on the terms of winning Reform seats or having Reform MPs to be a problem for the Tory party. When the Tory party is polling as low as it is currently polling, and, you know, there are lots of different pollsters out there, pick your own. You know, average at the moment looks about 25 points. There's been, you know, lots of people pay attention to the 20% one, but say they're probably around 25 points in the polls. If you have the Reform Party there, you're skimming the vote in lots of marginal seats, I think the feeling amongst Tory MPs is it could make the difference between them holding on to their seat or narrowly losing it. And therefore, when we're talking at the moment, which I think is a more likely conversation, which is what type of defeat is the Tory party heading to? A successful insurgent Reform party puts you more in Tory wipeout territory. And there was interesting polling a few weeks ago from Labour Together. And again, take it all with a pinch of salt, but they were effectively modelling different scenarios. Now, their aim is to say the election is much closer than you think, despite all the polls suggesting a huge Labour landslide. But one of the scenarios they modelled was what would happen if the Reform vote went away. And then things looked much closer.
Richard, this week's cover came about following Lee Anderson's defection from the Conservative Party to Reform, your party. So what do you feel that Lee Anderson offers Reform? And secondly, how optimistic are you feeling about having success in potentially Red Wall seats?
Well, we're delighted that the Lees joined Reform. Obviously, it gives us our first MP in the House of Commons. It was quite an emotional moment, actually, for me and the party to be sitting in the gallery for the first time, Lee taking his seat. It was a real thing. And in a sense, sort of validates 3 years of a lot of hard work and very often not a lot of thanks. But we are making great progress. And I think once you've got the first chink in the wall, it makes it much easier for other very anxious, very disappointed, unhappy Conservative MPs to say, well, actually, I can see where this is going. And so that's why I will be surprised if there's not more joining him either before or during the summer. as I think we make continuing progress. And what Lee, I mean, we've appointed him our champion of the Red Wall, and that I think is a very significant step. And millions of voters can see that actually Lee speaks, you know, Lee speaks for them. And the fact that we've in just 48 hours taken 2,000 new members is remarkable. We don't say our total membership, but that I think in any political party, that's a lot of new members in just 2 days. So yeah, we're delighted. And Lee brings a huge amount in many ways. And we've got our first tour with the bus and with Lee in his seat on this Friday.
And Richard, you're obviously attracting a lot of disaffected Tory voters, Conservative voters. But what do you say to the argument that a vote for reform, in effect, will all it will do is give Keir Starmer the biggest majority in British peacetime history?
Well, a couple of things. Firstly, the Conservative Party doesn't own the philosophy of conservatism. And secondly, if you promise to do things and then you fail, and in some cases deliberately betray what you promise to do, don't be surprised if someone's going to actually, you know, competition's a good thing. And don't be surprised if people say, actually, you deserve to be fired. I mean, if you employ a plumber to fix the plumbing and it still leaks, you get a different plumber. And the same is true in voting. So I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the Tories have broken Britain and they deserve to be fired comprehensively. But what Lee also brings is he brings, I think, a great deal of trust amongst disaffected former Labour voters who trusted Boris Johnson personally in 2019 and who might have either drifted to not vote at all or drifted back to Labour. I think Lee will give them real confidence, and so I think that this gives us a huge extra breadth, which we're very excited about.
Katie, there's another point you make in your piece, that this split on the right, it goes beyond particular issues such as Brexit, and perhaps it's more of a cultural split. Could you explain a bit more?
Yeah, I think it's hard to pin down exactly, but as I say in the piece, I don't think this is simply about Rishi Sunak, even Rishi Sunak versus reform. I think there was a question about conservatism and about the 2019 coalition. I think you can see that it is a real strain to hold it together. And whether it is before or after the election, and I think reform is going to play a role in this, what direction does it go in? And I think some of the splits we're currently seeing, it's a little bit Brexit. You look at the current Tory party, I think there's different views on taxation, or at least there are some who, I mean, everyone likes to say they're low tax, but I think there's a different appetite for the steps you might need to take to actually cut taxes by also not spooking the markets. But I think there's also a cultural point. I think there's the ECHR, you know, that's obviously a divisive issue, but also, if you look for, you know, on the cover, we have Lee Anderson's quote of, "I want my country back." And you look at the reason Lee Anderson, really, I think, probably the trigger to him joining reform, obviously he was on the reform watch list for some time, is the fact he lost the Tory whip for his comments on Islamists and Sadiq Khan. And therefore, I think it goes into what you want to say about extremism, but also about the social fabric of the UK and where the line is on talking about that. But I think, as you say, there's something about style too, which is lots of the things when people say, oh, the Tories should just be a bit more like reform to absorb reform. Well, Rishi Sunak has done quite a few of those things. Now, you can debate it, but he has taken steps on net zero, which Boris Johnson would not do. He has, you know, today we're talking on a week where there's new moves on extremism to try and take it further in terms of what you can crack down on. But also there's just the vibe of Rishi Sunak. It's this quite managerial, polite man who I think, obviously he did bring David Cameron back, which is partly what is fueling this, but he seems a little bit more Cameroon than this rebel. Therefore, I think there is a tone thing, which is, do you sound as though you are, you know, someone who wants to shake things up, or do you sound as though you want to stay within the system? And I think lots of people think that is partly where it could go after the election in terms of, you know, whether it's inside or outside the Conservative bracket.
The cultural thing is really strong, and it's already resonating massively, this slogan, "We want our country back." And we're going to major on that, because that actually really appeals to your traditionally patriotic, socially conservative Labour voter, former Labour voter, no voter, who are wondering in fury, what has happened? How has our country become so broken? And, you know, that means being strong on law and order, strong on immigration, getting rid of the ECHR, strong on pride in our British culture, strong on defence. And these are really, really important things. And also, frankly, saying we don't want extremists taking over our streets. We don't want gender ideology poisoning the minds of our children. And we don't want mass immigration. And the fact that Reform is prepared to tell that as it is, and it may make the lefty establishment very uncomfortable in the centre of London, but out there in real Britain, it resonates very strongly. And not just in the red wall, but actually I think in the blue wall amongst traditional Conservative members.
And Richard, who, I mean, you've obviously given a bit of a picture there of who the typical Reform voter is, but are you finding, as well as disaffected Tories, are people from the left also moving more towards Reform at this point?
Very much so, because they like that strong cultural message. Strong on law and order, strong on secure borders, stopping the boats, freezing immigration so that the country can catch up, sort of pause for breath, and a real sort of strong sense of, actually, we believe in who we are, where we've come from, our heritage, our history. You know, millions of people, particularly on the left, are sick and tired of being told that you've got to be guilty for being British. You've got to be guilty for being, you know, grown up and being born in the United Kingdom. You've got to be guilty because of the colour of your skin. I mean, this is just, it's gone way, way too far the other way. And that, I think, is a real appeal.
Rod Liddell has also written in his column for the magazine this week, Richard, that he's a bit unimpressed with Reform, you might be sad to hear. He thinks that admiration that a lot of people in the party, I believe such as yourself, have for Margaret Thatcher is rather off-putting for many voters in the North and the Midlands. He thinks that the one-in, one-out policy on immigration has a certain allure, but will be prevented by teams of lawyers. So he seems to think that what Reform offers doesn't amount to much other than just, we're not the Tories.
Well, Rod's a good man, but you'd expect that from someone in a party that has been around for 20 years and doesn't register on any polls any week of any month of any year. Bless him. So, and the reality is, maybe there's a little bit of jealousy creeping in with dear Rod, in that we're now heading towards 15% fast. We're obviously doing something right, and we're obviously peeling across a much broader range of people than perhaps Rod gives us credit for. But I saw the piece. In fairness, I think the headline probably wasn't written by Rod.
Though I do think in defence of Rod, when you look at some of the things Reform is saying, Richard, so, for example, you've got, you know, the contract you have on your website, and it does read more like a charge sheet against the Conservatives than, I think, necessarily a manifesto for Reform. You know, Britain has a housing crisis, record NHS waiting lists, a benefits crisis, record crime, net zero is making us poorer and colder.
But it does set out all the solutions to that. I mean, it's a 30-page contract. Yeah. It's costed and setting out big solutions on all the big issues of the day. And in particular, maybe for another time, but our solutions on healthcare, for example, we want to be at the centre of a proper debate about how we improve healthcare. And we've got big solutions to that. We're allocating an extra $17 billion to healthcare, but not to bungling, incompetent NHS managers. We've got to boost the independent market. We're saying to people, if you can afford to pay a bit more, you should pay a bit more. We're going to incentivise you through the tax system to do so. Competition's a great thing. It drives up standards and drives down costs. So, yeah, there's lots of things in there. And there's also a really important thing that nobody is properly addressing, I suspect, because most people don't understand it. You know, why is the Bank of England voluntarily paying £35 billion worth of taxpayers' cash this year to city institutions on the interest on all the QE money printed? Other central banks are not doing that. There's no obligation to do that. Former deputy governors saying we shouldn't do that. So there's plenty of savings that can be made that people in Westminster are not properly addressing.
And Richard, just finally, what about Farage? Are you hoping that he might give your campaign a rocket boost at some point?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm constantly asked this question, and I say the more help, the better. I mean, just imagine, we're polling 13, 14, soon to be 15% without Nigel. Rocket boosters, a bit of a turbo with Nigel, all of a sudden we'll be polling ahead of the Tories. And then, frankly, it becomes ever more credible to say, actually, it's not us splitting the vote, Tories, it's you guys. You need to go into the corner, shuffle off, stand aside and let us take on Keir Starmer.
Hmm. Well, Katie, I don't suppose it's possible to read the mind of the man, but do you have any hint as to why Nigel Farage isn't getting as involved this time in in the Reform Party?
Well, I think there's an American election, isn't there, in November, and there's lots of lucrative opportunities probably surrounding that. I'm probably allowed to say that Richard might not be. And I think that, of course, Nigel Farage wants to position himself as Trump's, you know, UK ambassador, even though he's never going to get the role from the Tories probably in their current form, or a Labour government. I think when you speak to figures in Reform, they often talk about how this, you know, this isn't a one election project. And I think they themselves, in the way that you've seen the UKIP, Brexit Party, all these parties often, they don't reap seats in general elections. So what metric are you judging it on? And I think therefore the idea is, could you get 15% of the vote? Could you get 5 million votes in a general election? Can you retain 300 deposits? At that point, can you start to say in the event of a massive Tory defeat, which Reform have been quite honest that they would like to see, even if that means Keir Starmer, can you start to see the beginnings of a new party that you can build up to an electoral force by the time of the next election?
I think you can safely say that Nigel is very focused on the realignment of the right. He's talked about it
globally.
But in particular in the United Kingdom. And there is, if you look at how this plays out, it's quite clear to see how this, you could have the Conservative Party basically renaming itself the sort of the Social Democrat Party. And then there being an alternative realignment of the right. So there's all sorts. I think the real thing that is different this time is that we're not a single issue party. We've got a very serious contract for solving the much greater problems this country's ever faced in our lifetime. And, you know, we're very focused on that. And I just think we feel that this time it's very different. And no one knows with first past the post actually how brutal this could get for the Conservative Party if they creep, because it, in the same way that it's hard for small parties to grow, equally for a major party that starts to slip below 20, 21, 19%, it's cataclysmic on the downward side as well.
Richard and Katie, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Laura, what else did you enjoy in the magazine this week?
I really enjoyed Peter Manderson's diary, Will, and he starts it by saying, well, explaining rather why on his podcast, How to Win an Election, he ended up fat-shaming, as he says, Keir Starmer. He then goes into being outed by a Spectator editor who spotted him sneaking into the Marylebone branch of St John Restaurant to buy a donut. So I think it's quite a funny elision of these two stories. So I'd recommend that to readers. And finally, I also really enjoyed Lloyd Evans' Life column this week, in which he explains rather amusingly why he has decided to sell his vote to his son. And he talks us through that. I'm not sure that's technically legal, but he explains his thinking. What about you, Will? What did you enjoy?
There's a piece I really want your attention to by Sean Thomas about getting absolutely high off his face on psychedelics in the Amazon. Having just been to Pablo Escobar's old house. That's Pablo Escobar, of course, the famous drug lord, and how his house is now been turned into a garish, plasticky, hippo-themed children's water park, and what it's like tripping on psychedelics having just been to this place. It's one of these pieces that perhaps is quite hard to explain why it's so brilliant, because it's got these sort of very odd ingredients to it. But it is, I think, just a wonderful piece of writing, and we're going to hear an extract from it read by Sean now.
A ceremony in a wooden hilltop pyramid begins after nightfall. The fire is set. Songs are sung. We drink the cup of bittersweet yahe and settle back in slightly uncomfortable chairs around the psychonautical pyramid. After 30 minutes of vague warbling and silent fire gazing, I check my watch and wonder if the drugs are duds. It happens. After another hour of nothing, I think, this is pointless. I look at my watch again and realise that, in reality, only a minute has passed. Temporal dilation is one of the first symptoms of ayahuasca intoxication. Now the yahe kicks in. My hands suddenly seem to be made of tungsten. Also, they are emitting yellow and violet sparks, and a lattice of crimson Incan motifs is forming to my left. When I look at the burning fire, I notice it is levitating up to the ceiling. A delicately luminous moth alights on my arm and smirks at me. My lepidopterology is rusty, but smirking seems unusual. At this point, the guilt comes knocking. This is a traditional part of the ayahuasca trip, when you go over your lifelong litany of failures, doubts, and cruelties, and it often leads to a terrible self-reckoning. But just as I am sinking into remorse, I look down and realize I'm floating over an Aztec temple made of hexagonal sapphires. The hallucinations are back, but they are so intense I can barely take notes. At one point I wonder why I am yawning so much. At another, I write down the important lesson, "Whoa, that looks weird, don't look at it," which is possibly a good motto for life. Later on I write, "At least I haven't shat myself yet." Another handy lifetime motto.
Will, you also write from a, I think, quite heartfelt position this week about this new report from something called the Oversight Group, which the Church of England has seems to have taken on board. You're about to explain more in detail, but we're joined now by the Reverend Dr. Jamie Franklin from Holy Trinity Winchester, and he's also the host of the podcast Irreverent, Faith and Current Affairs. Well, in the magazine this week, you've written about the Church of England's latest apology, and you say it's tantamount to apologising for Christianity itself. For listeners who might not yet be aware of what's going on, could you start by taking us through it?
Yeah, so the first thing to say, I suppose, is that the Church of England have not issued a formal apology yet, but there is a question of if they will do so, and if they do, what that apology will look like, how it will be phrased. Now, what they're apologising for, or suggesting should be apologised for, comes from the Oversight Group, which was a body set up to investigate the Church of England's links to the slave trade, historic links to the slave trade. And it has quite a few demands within it. The one that got all the media attention last week is this £1 billion reparations fund. But aside from the financial demands of the report, the thing that I found most striking and actually quite distressing is the spiritual demands of the report, because what it wants is for the Church of England to issue a public apology for, and I'm quoting here, seeking to destroy diverse African traditional religious belief systems. Now, I don't see how that can be interpreted in any other way except apologizing for spreading the gospel, because what is missionary if not replacing a set of religious beliefs with another set of religious beliefs? And I think if the Church of England were to take on this recommendation from the Oversight Group and to issue an apology worded in those terms, then I think it would be an apology for Christianity itself. Now, I should say that a Church of England spokesman got back to me on this and said that no, this is not how the Church interprets these words. They don't interpret it as an apology for spreading the gospel. We have to be transparent about the appalling abuses that took place in the past. If the Church wants to apologise for the abuses that went on by certain missionaries in history and where it went wrong, it absolutely could do so. But it's very Church of England, I think, to accidentally end up apologising for Christianity. It's like the bit in Withnil and I, help, we've gone on holiday by mistake. It's like you've become so self-flagellating and have such a lack of confidence in yourself that you end up apologising for Christianity by mistake.
Jamie, what did you make of the findings of the Oversight Group and perhaps more importantly, the decision of the Church to, quote, warmly welcome its findings?
Well, I think Will has said it very, very well there, and I completely agree with him. And in some ways, the clarification, or the so-called clarification from the anonymous Church of England spokesman, sort of encapsulates the problem, is that this report is typical of the kind of ambiguous, wishy-washy language that comes out from the centralised Church of England so often. And it gives the impression, as Will quite rightly says, that Christian missionaries, Anglican missionaries in the past, were actually wrong to preach the gospel and to convert the African natives from their pagan, idolatrous practices to Christianity. And this is something that's sort of fundamentally, sort of inherently wrong. Now, you notice when the spokesman offers his clarification, he speaks vaguely about abuses that were perpetrated in the past. But even that is not specified. It's not said what these abuses are, and it never is, because all of these things are just implied. It's always implied that in the past it was Christians and it was white people and it was British people who were abusing the saintly indigenous populations and things of this sort. But it's never actually specified who actually did what and when. So it just gives you this vague impression that the white Christians are the oppressors. And there are two things about this. Firstly, it's historically extremely misleading. It's never mentioned, for example, that it was in the Christian millennium that slavery basically died out by the beginning of the second millennium, and that it was Christians who abolished slavery or began the abolition process in Britain in the 19th century with, you know, the evangelical Clapham sect and all this kind of thing. But then even worse, on a kind of, I don't know if it's even worse, but it's still bad. On a practical level, the Church of England is implicitly promoting an ideology which is inimical towards Christianity. To Christianity, it's antagonistic towards Christianity. So if we promote this ideology, we're just going to destroy the message that we are meant to be propagating. So it's a really bad idea, in my opinion, for these reasons.
Well, I completely agree that the how non-specific it is, how broad it is such a big part of the problem. I mean, another part of the phrasing, which is just so broad that if you really think about its implications, it gets alarming pretty quickly, is when it says diverse African traditional belief systems, what's it actually referring to? It's not saying cultural systems, by the way. It's saying belief systems. Does that include, you've mentioned idolatry, does that also include witchcraft, twin killing, at the most extreme end of the spectrum, cannibalism, human sacrifice? I mean, these were all religious practices done in the name of religion. Are we saying it was wrong to seek to replace those with Christianity? I mean, I would argue very much not. And the point is that if it wanted to apologize for specific things, so I spoke for the piece to Michael Nazir Ali, the former the retired bishop of Rochester, who now has converted to Catholicism, precisely because he's sick of a lot of this sort of nonsense in the Church of England. And he gave quite an example of, you know, there's things such as the eradication of the use of drums in worship because of pagan associations. Whereas actually now we could probably acknowledge that there are ways you can incorporate drums into Christian worship and it wouldn't be a problem. But the report doesn't say anything these things specifically. And by not being specific, it is leaving the field open to such horrible misinterpretation that I just think that church leaders, if they're going to implement the recommendations of this report, they should demand a change to the wording, or they should reword this penitent section of the report, because I think it is so loosely worded as to be very worrying in what it's saying.
Yeah, can I add as well, just on the report, Will, it also says that it encourages the church to facilitate work that builds the spiritual connection of Africa and the African diaspora with the gospel and the diverse spiritual practices of African forebears. Now, it's really difficult to know how to interpret that phrase apart from as a kind of syncretistic universalist view, which is essentially equating Christianity with, quote, diverse spiritual practices of African forebears. It's implying an equivalence between Christianity and those spiritual practices. And there's no other way of reading that. I cannot see any other way of reading that. It's just diminishing Christianity to the point where it's basically an irrelevance.
And the irrelevance point I find is so interesting because, as I say in the piece, many missionaries, of course, especially as missionary went on, were African. They were black African. They were some of the most devout, faithful, and brave people you could hope to come across, because they were horribly persecuted for converting to Christianity. And I gave lots of examples of this in the piece. And if you're the implication of the words in this report are that, in a way, why should they have bothered converting if they could keep a lot of these old practices? It actually all along was optional. I mean, who would have known? You could have kept ancestor worship, maybe, or bits of idolatry, or, I mean, I don't know exactly which bits the report thinks they should have kept, but apparently they could have done and perhaps should have done. And I think it's an insult to the memory of those missionaries and who often were martyrs, literally martyrs.
It's also an insult to the Orthodox conservative Christians, many of whom are Anglicans in Africa, today. It wouldn't at all see an equivalence between Christianity and the pagan idolatrous practices that they rejected to embrace Christ. So
90% of the Christians persecuted for their faith in the world today are African Christians. It is where the most persecution of Christians happens, is in Africa. And as you say, Jamie, I mean, it's a sort of insult to them in the way that they're currently living in their faith. I would have to ask you, Jamie, do you think that there's a changing understanding from certain leaders in the Church of England of what sin is? You know, it's sort of, we're getting into a point now where sin is like a cultural collective sin, in that almost secular, anti-colonialist, anti-imperial mindset that we see in everything now. That the idea of sin has been interpreted in those terms rather than in the traditional Christian understanding of personal sin.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that sin is understood in a kind of in a sort of neo-Marxist structural sense. So sin exists in structures rather than in the heart of the individual. And so what we need to do as human beings is we need to band together, you know, not just Christians, but Christians in the other religions and all the secular people. We need to band together in order to ameliorate social conditions, which is different to the traditional Christian understanding, which is that we are sinful as individuals, and that we need to repent of our sin and gradually put it aside as we grow in holiness, and that this will be the thing that actually changes the world and ameliorates society. So I do think it's a very different understanding of sin. The other thing I would add, just sort of theologically, is I think that the issue here really is universalism. This underlies much of the controversy in the church, is that, is Christianity uniquely and critically important to humanity? Or is it just one way of many ways of, say, being a good human and ameliorating conditions in society? The answer to that question, I think, will determine what one thinks about this issue and many of the other issues in the church.
Father Franklin, Will, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Will, was there anything else this week that you particularly enjoyed?
I think there's a really interesting letter from Cape Town by Sam Kiley about how the ANC's grip over South Africa is loosening. But he's also got this brilliant anecdote in it where he describes meeting a South African gangster who says he got on very well with them, but the first time they met, he shoved the barrel of his shining revolver into Sam's mouth, which made him gag, but also made him laugh. And so ever since then, they got on rather well. I thought that was just a very evocative description of this first meeting. And how about you? Anything else that you particularly like?
Two things, really. The art scene, I think, is particularly interesting. It's Calvin Poe writing about a style of architecture called tropical modernism, which flourished in West Africa and India. And he says, growing up in Hong Kong, he'd never been quite able to distinguish the style of architecture, but seeing this new exhibition at the V&A, it sort of brought everything together for him. And I also would like to draw people's attention to a Dear Mary this week, who is asked whether it's bad manners for someone to arrive at a party and ask immediately for the Wi-Fi code. And I think it is incredibly rude. What do you think, Will?
No, completely agree. Unless there's a very, very good reason. But
I think unless you're in the middle of nowhere and you have a very specific reason why you need to get a hold of the internet, I think it is quite rude.
Yeah. The final story we're going to discuss in a little bit more detail is pegged to the news this week that the Boucher Report has found that Steak Knife, a British Army agent employed as an infiltrator in the IRA, might have instigated more deaths than lives he saved during his time embedded in the terrorist organisation. Alistair Palmer wrote about this for the magazine this week, and he argues that infiltrators such as Steak Knife must have licence to do whatever's necessary when fighting terrorism. Alistair joined us along with Douglas Murray, the Spectator's associate editor and the author of the award-winning book Bloody Sunday, Truth, Lies and the Savile Inquiry. I started by asking Alistair to summarise for listeners who was Steak Knife and what the Boucher Report found.
Well, Steak Knife was basically universally acknowledged to have been a man called Freddie Scappaticci. He joined the IRA early on. He met Gerry Adams in prison. He was imprisoned. I think he was swept up in the internment arrests, which were happened in a big scale at the end of the 60s, was it? When they were just arresting everybody who was on the street. Anyway, that helped to radicalize him further. He eventually made his way up inside the IRA to eventually became head of the IRA's internal security unit, which was the organization that it had for identifying and interrogating and executing people who they thought were working for the British in one way or another. Now, of course, the big irony was that he, Scappaticci, was working for the British. He was a British Army agent. And so he turned out to be immensely valuable because in that position he was, as they some of the other IRA people have subsequently said, you know, right at the heart of what the IRA's tactics were and what its strategy was. Now, government, central government in the UK, decided that there needed to be an investigation into how on earth the British state had been employing somebody who was torturing and killing people, because he was paid as well. He was an official employee, Scappaticci, Steak Knife. And so John Boucher was given the task of trying to investigate exactly what he, Scappaticci, had done. But it does make a lot of quite general moralistic statements about how wrong it was that Article 2 of the European Convention of Human Rights was not respected. Article 2 is the right to life, and the state has, under that convention, has the obligation to respect everybody's right to life and therefore, wherever possible, to intervene to prevent the loss of life. And it's quite clear that in Scappaticci's case, they didn't do that, partly because they didn't want to expose him because he was too important, because he was able to say to the British Army, look, Gerry Adams leads a faction that is actually serious about negotiation. It is worth trying to engage with Gerry Adams because he wants to find a way to stop the fighting, stop the killing. You know, and that was very, very, and the similar things were very, very important for the peace process. And it's a pity that in his report, Boucher was not able to recognize that.
Yeah. Oh, Douglas, I would love to get your opinion on this, because for your award-winning book, Bloody Sunday, you research the tactics of those who are embedded in the IRA, including those of Steak Knife. Do you, in your opinion, do such tactics work, and can they be justified? Do you think that the Boucher report is perhaps falling into moralistic statements, which is how Alistair Just phrased it?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that this is another reminder of the fact that inquiries of this kind don't really tell us very much. There have been a number of similar reports in recent years that have been similarly unhelpful in actually uncovering anything very new. One famous case a few years ago, somebody shot in prison. The report ended up finding out, you know, that the gun had been got into the prison and somebody had shot it, but we didn't learn much more. Similarly, with the Steak Knife investigation, we don't really know anything much more than everybody who'd followed this case already knew. With the tactics were tactics that the British employed in the dirty war in Northern Ireland. And what Steak Knife did was very similar to what a large number of other agents were doing. What made him different was that already mentioned by Alistair, that he was actually the head of the internal nutting squad of the IRA. And to that extent, he was a particularly prized asset because of the information that he was able to gather because of the trust that was put in him by the provisional IRA. I think that it's a very telling thing, I have to say, that we're still getting reports like this so many years after actually the Bloody Sunday report, when the then Northern Ireland minister said to me that one of the things that the Savile inquiry showed was that actually this should probably be an end to inquiries of this kind. The reason I say this is because, first of all, the reason why I think some numbers of Northern Ireland ministers have felt this, although haven't necessarily acted on it, is that firstly, there's a lot of, I think, smoke still around, partly because there are certain people, certain informers who are still alive and wouldn't be able to be identified or shouldn't be identified. And so we get this very unclear picture, as we do here. or not very helpful or constructive picture. And the second thing is that, of course, the tendency of these inquiries is, as again here, to look at activities of the British state and the FRU and others, other arms of the British state. That, of course, gives a completely lopsided view of the conflict in Northern Ireland, because, of course, there has not been and there will not be similar inquiries into agents of the IRA, activities of members of the IRA, many of whom are still alive, many of whom are protected by secret letters handed out secretly around the time of the Good Friday Agreement. And as a result, the whole history of the conflict ends up being tilted so that the activities of the British are endlessly poured over, as I said, not to very much effect, whilst, you know, far more killings and far more blood on the hands of far more people on the side of the provisional IRA just sort of washes past. Indeed, it's thought rather wrong to look into them. It's very striking, even the language around it is always that if you want to look into the cases of people like Stakeknife and expose whatever was done in the name of the state, you're said to be on the side of justice. Whereas if you would like to find out what happened on the side of the IRA, you are anti-peace. Of course, the justification for that that's always given is, well, there's that one is the British state. And the answer to that is, well, yes. And the other side is people who are running or want to run, both the devolved assembly in Stormont and also, of course, have significant political impact now in Dublin. So actually, we're talking about state actors all across the board now.
I mean, I agree with most of what Douglas has said, particularly about reports, but I would like to identify one exception to the general uninformativeness of the reports, and that is several years ago, a QC called Desmond De Silva did a very thorough and very useful report into the killing of Pat Finucane, who was a Catholic lawyer, by the Protestant paramilitaries.
Can I add one? Sorry, but I do just have to add one thing, which is that, of course, the report into Finucane's murder is a classic example of what I just described. Because, of course, there was an investigation, a report into the killing of Pat Finucane, but there would never be a report into the fact, of course, that Pat Finucane was a member of the IRA himself, shouldn't have been killed, but was a member of the IRA, always denied being so, but I know he was a member of the IRA because he used to go to IRA council meetings, among other things, with my late friend Sean O'Callaghan, who was at the meetings, who was also a double agent. But so yes, I mean, it's a classic example of it. You get only half the picture through this form of inquiry, and not even that.
But if it's done properly, you do get an interesting. As I said, I think the De Silva report.
It's interesting, but the point of this is the point of the inquiry is not simply meant to be interesting to Northern Ireland historians, but the claim, of course, that put by on behalf of the families of people like the Finucane family is that this is going to get truth and reconciliation. In actual fact, you get a little bit of the truth on one side and not any on the other.
There's one point in your piece I'd just like to finish on, Alistair, if I may, which kind of leads on from the point you were saying about the point that Major made about this will put agents off becoming agents. And that is that the European Convention of Human Rights, which is what is advocated for in the Boucher Report, compromises British agents. So if that is the case, would you advocate for a withdrawal of the UK from the ECHR?
Well, I wouldn't actually, because I think that it's really a question of how that is applied rather than whether it's applied at all. I mean, I think it's a big question about whether it's appropriate to continue with that being members of that convention or not, that isn't particularly settled one way or another by considering these issues. I mean, you can be very sure that in every other European country, they have faced exactly the same problems, and particularly in France, I'm sure, they deal with them in their own way and they do not pay scrupulous attention to Article 2 of the convention when they're dealing with their own agents inside extremist terrorist organizations of one kind or another. So, there are always, even within the EHCR, there are always get outs. I mean, you know, you can take life in order to preserve more life. It's not, and what I'm saying is, it's not a sort of absolute prohibition. They are willing to admit that.
And Douglas, your thoughts?
I mean, I think it's fascinating that this is a conclusion that you've come to. I mean, I think that it's unbelievable that the report should end up relying on Article 2 of the ECHR. My own views on this were fixed 23 years ago now, when Strasbourg ruled against the British government in a case which was very, very important and remains very important, which is the case of Kelly and others against the UK. Patrick Kelly and seven other members of the IRA were trying to carry out a bomb and gun attack on a police station in Loughgall in 1987. They were stopped from doing so by the SAS.
Intelligence. We knew it was going to happen, and they were waiting for to kill them all, which was the right thing to do.
It was an extremely successful operation. And however, the families of the IRA terrorists who, as I say, literally had a primed bomb and guns and were in the midst of carrying out attack, took the UK government to Strasbourg, which ruled then back in 2001. So, I mean, it's not like this is a fresh debate. Back in 2001, Strasbourg ruled that the British government had broken the Article 2 right to life of the IRA terrorists killed in the middle of carrying out an operation and were ordered to pay compensation to the relatives. I've thought ever since May 2001, when that judgment came in, that the British government should withdraw from the ECHR immediately, because it made it clear that Britain and our security services could not carry out actions in defence of the British public, and that if an international court ruled against our own security in such a manner, we should withdraw from that. I think it's been clear for a very long time. The fact that 23 years later, an investigation into Steak Knife has to rely on Article 2 of the ECHR again just shows how redundant this particular act is.
Alistair and Douglas, thank you very much indeed for joining me. Thank you.
And that's everything this week. We've been reading lots of your feedback and it's all been very helpful, so please do keep the comments coming in. If you'd like to let us know what you think about this new style of podcast, just email podcast@spectator.co.uk. I'm Laura Prendergast.
And I'm William Moore. And we hope you'll join us again next week.